So, good evening. Tonight we come to the fifth chapter in the Life Divine, published in December of 1914. We have seen him set the stage with fundamental ideas which will remain through us throughout the rest of our study of the Life Divine. That there is a reality. That the void is not the truth of all being. That this reality that he asserts is omnipresent. It is all comprehensive. It is non-being. It is being. It is all planes of the becoming. It is what is transcendent. It is what becomes concrete in the cosmos. It is the living truth in the individual. So far, he's examined the reality as a transcendence and asserted its cosmic dimensionality. Now, he turns to the third term of existence, the individual, and I'm sure you're all concerned about the destiny of the individual, so we'd be delighted to take this up. He opens with a pair of citations, both drawn from the Isha Upanishad. Remember, at the time that he's writing this, he's also translating and discussing the Isha Upanishad in the pages of the Arya. The verses that he looks at here, he won't get to until the subsequent issue, until January, but he's already rendered them. He retranslates them here. Let's look at how he's translated it in the motto right under the chapter title. By the ignorance, they cross beyond death, and by the knowledge, enjoy immortality. By the non-birth, they cross beyond death, and by the birth, enjoy immortality. He's done this a little differently in his translation, which has already appeared in the pages of the Arya. And let's read the entirety of the 11th verse in English. He who knows that as both in one, the knowledge and the ignorance, by the ignorance crosses beyond death, and by the knowledge enjoys immortality. And the 14th, he who knows that as both in one, the birth and the dissolution of birth, by the dissolution crosses beyond death, and by the birth enjoys immortality. Now, there's a philosophy in those. We'll restrict ourselves to the chapter in front of us, but very pregnant verses taken as whole. Note also that he has, in translating it for the motto tonight that we're looking at, translated one, the singular, as plural, they. So now we begin with a summary statement that opens the chapter. And let's remember, too, that Sri Aurobindo was writing a journal. So every month, when he starts a new chapter, he has to take something from the previous argument and put it before us in somewhat different language, more tightly constructed, so as to present the gist to us so that we know where we are in the thread of the thing. So this restates what we've already looked at earlier. And of course, the idea of the omnipresent reality goes back to how Sri Aurobindo titled the first book, that is to say, the first 28 chapters of The Life Divine, when it was released in 1939, after his accident, when it appeared as a book for the first time. So here we go again. An omnipresent reality is the truth of all life and existence, whether absolute or relative, whether corporeal or incorporeal, whether animate or inanimate, whether intelligent or unintelligent. And in all its infinitely varying and even constantly opposed self-expressions, from the contradictions nearest to our ordinary experience to those remotest antinomies which lose themselves on the verges of the ineffable, the reality is one and not a sum or concourse. There's much in this. An omnipresent reality that swallows transcendence, which is beyond space and time, swallows all the movement of a becoming in space and time. Whether we're talking about that which is sheer material formation, the life that informs it, the ideation that gives rise to it all, because creation, to Sri Aurobindo, is a manifestation of a supreme intelligence and energy. And even if we look at the contradictions and the oppositions which we meet continually in nature, even those are reconciled in this omnipresence, in this ever-present origin, to borrow a different phrase from a different book. Reality is one. It is not one numerically. It is not a sum. It is not one by means of all roads leading to the same place. It is one because it is the only thing that exists. There is no other. So Sri Aurobindo's idea of what oneness is and what reality is exceeds the monism of Shankara, because it denies reality to nothing. All are part and parcel, as it were, of that single conscious existence. He continues, from that, all variations begin. In that, all variations consist. To that, all variations return. In this echoes the Taittiriya Upanishad. Remember, the son is instructed by the father to go seek that from which all things come, that which in which all things persist, and that into which all things pass. And he finds that same reality in a multiformal universe, a ladder of existence that goes up and disappears into delight. All affirmations are denied only to lead to a wider affirmation of the same reality. This is a signpost for us as we begin our quest to the cosmic, to what is transcosmic. that as we grow, our comprehension of these things should exclude nothing but become more all-embracing, more convincingly one. All antinomies confront each other in order to recognize one truth in their opposed aspects and embrace, by the way of conflict, their mutual unity. Brahman is the Alpha and the Omega. Brahman is the one besides whom there is nothing else existent. The Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last letters of the alphabet, the original Greek alphabet from which alphabet comes. Interesting that he would use that here, because Brahman is that which is the spoken reality. When the Supreme speaks, Brahman is the speech. Brahman is the head of all society, because it is that in which the sacred word resides. The word creates. This will have echoes to some of you, I think. As we've noted before, in Judaism, in the Kabbalah, in Christianity, the Logos, that, and in the Tantra, Vak, this is the beginning of reality. The beginning and the end, Sri Aurobindo insists, it is both Alpha and Omega. The world is spoken by that great speech. The world is taken back in. That breath which gave it life is that breath which is taken back in. It is inhaled, it is exhaled. The universe comes, the universe goes. But always, Brahman is one. Brahman is the one besides whom there is nothing else existent. So, let's continue with the next paragraph. But this unity is in its nature indefinable. When we seek to envisage it by the mind, we are compelled to proceed through an infinite series of conceptions and experiences. And yet in the end, we are obliged to negate our largest conceptions, our most comprehensive experiences, in order to affirm that the reality exceeds all definitions. We arrive at the formula of the Indian sages, neti, neti. It is not this, it is not that. There is no experience by which we can limit it. There is no conception by which it can be defined. If you're looking for the citation for that, that is from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Not this, not that. In the last chapter, Sri Aurobindo discussed the nature of the unknowable, which presents itself to us as a kind of non-being. And so now, having described that the reality is indescribable, we take up this unknowable again. An unknowable which appears to us in many states and attributes of being, in many forms of consciousness, in many activities of energy. This is what mind can ultimately say about the existence which we ourselves are and which we see in all that is presented to our thought and senses. It is in and through those states, those forms, those activities that we have to approach and know the unknowable. But if in our haste to arrive at a unity that our mind can seize and hold, if in our insistence to confine the infinite in our embrace, we identify the reality with any one definable state of being, however pure and eternal, with any particular attribute, however general and comprehensive, with any fixed formulation of consciousness, however vast in its scope, with any energy or activity, however boundless its application, and if we exclude all the rest, then our thoughts sin against its unknowableness and arrive not at a true unity, but at a division of the indivisible. So the mind's knowledge always limits. The mind approaches and falls back on attaining. Even when we try to describe the universal, even when we experience it, we cannot put it into words. We cannot find the mentation that puts its arm around it. We cannot contain it. Thought is outstretched by that which is real. So not to deny, but when presented with that which exceeds our conception, we have again to enlarge our conception, or better still, to silence the mind and experience that in the purity of our consciousness, which alone can enter into that being. And then, what is capable to the mind's current powers can be extended again in conceptive thought. And by then we know, because our experience is so deep, that even this is the merest indication of what that immensity might be, because we cannot capture the infinite. It is all exceeding. It has intrinsic to it a power of freedom from its manifestation, even as it has the freedom to manifest, both to become and to restrain its being in its unutterable transcendence belong to it. So strongly was this truth perceived in the ancient times, writes Sri Aurobindo, that the Vedantic seers, even after they had arrived at the crowning idea, the convincing experience of Satchit Ananda as the highest positive expression of the reality to our consciousness, erected in their speculations or went on in their perceptions to an asat, a non-being beyond, which is not the ultimate existence, the pure consciousness, the infinite bliss of which all our experiences are the expression or the deformation. Let's pause and remember that Satchit Ananda is Sat, which means existence, pure being, Chit, which means consciousness. Sri Aurobindo will later come to identify it with consciousness power, consciousness force, and Ananda, which means bliss, Sat Chit Ananda. Now here it's been transliterated in this way, which we can get used to seeing. Satchit Ananda is a formulation which does not occur in the Upanishads. We only meet it later in the Brahma Sutras. That's where it is first used. Although formulations close to this do appear in some of the Upanishads, like the Taittiriya. And Sat-Chit-Ananda is what the mind at its highest is capable of cognizing. It is the positive expression of being. But remember, Sri Aurobindo has been long in deliberation to bring into the equation of this omnipresent reality the possibility that there is something beyond even that positive being, that there is an asat and asat. If sat is the ground in which sat-chit ananda expresses itself, then asat would be that unknowable behind, not a negation of all being, but that transcendence, that freedom, that the unknowable that always contains within itself, not to manifest, to exceed, so that even the infinite expression of sat-chit ananda does not exhaust what that unknowable reality might be. So let's continue. If at all an existence, a consciousness of bliss, it is beyond the highest and purest positive form of these things that here we can possess, and other, therefore, than what here we know by these names. Buddhism, somewhat arbitrarily declared by the theologians to be an unvedic doctrine because it rejected the authority of the scriptures, yet goes back to this essentially Vedantic conception. Well, again, this is a rather a Mahayanist interpretation of Buddhism. We can say certainly that Buddhism not only rejected the Veda, but rejected the central idea of the Veda, that the sacrifice, the yajna, had meaning and could deliver the soul to an ultimate good. So the tradition of India, in seeing that Buddhism was an orthodox school of wisdom, was certainly well-founded. And we continue. Only the positive and synthetic teaching of the Upanishads held sat and asat not as opposites destructive of each other, but as the last antinomy through which we look up to the unknowable. And of course, we have seen this in the Chandogya and the Brihadaranyaka. And in the transactions of our positive consciousness, even unity has to make its account with multiplicity, for the many also are Brahman. And virtually all the Upanishads that we've had any contact with over these months have said exactly that. And so now we are coming to the core of the Isha's view of things. As he writes, it is by vidya, the knowledge of the oneness, that we know God. Without it, avidya, the relative and multiple consciousness, is a night of darkness and a disorder of ignorance. So we have to have that. In other words, spiritual knowledge is quintessentially important to understanding the nature of reality. We have to have that breakthrough and gain that experience of the eternal. We must have that. Yet, he continues, if we exclude the field of that ignorance, if we get rid of avidya as if it were a thing non-existent and unreal, then knowledge itself becomes a sort of obscurity and a source of imperfection. We become as men blinded by a light so that we can no longer see the field which that light illumines. And of course, this is taking the construction of the Isha Upanishad and translated into plain English here. So, Sri Aurobindo is writing a translation of the Isha Upanishad and giving a lengthy commentary to it, which is unrolling month after month in the pages of the Arya. And he's also coming back to it here. This is how thoroughly grounded the Life Divine is in the Ishu Upanishad, which insists that all this is Brahman. And it is in finding Brahman in all states, in what appears to be dark as well as what appears to be light, that we gain great wisdom and great happiness. And in that, we escape dissolution into death. So, continuing with the next paragraph, such is the teaching, calm, wise, and clear, of our most ancient sages. They had the patience and the strength to find and to know. They had also the clarity and humility to admit the limitation of our knowledge. They perceived the borders where it has to pass into something beyond itself, that transversal line that we've spoken about so often. It was a later impatience of heart and mind, vehement attraction to an ultimate bliss or high masterfulness of pure experience and trenchant intelligence, which sought the one to deny the many. And because it had received the breath of the heights, scorned or recoiled from the secret of the depths. In other words, this is the limited kind of oneness presented by the Advaita school of Vedanta. Not that it is the only school of Vedanta. The Upanishads had a greater teaching, which Shankara and Gaudapada narrowed. Sri Aurobindo consistently rejects that perspective. But the steady eye of the ancient wisdom perceived that to know God really, it must know him everywhere equally and without distinction, considering and valuing, but not mastered by the oppositions through which he shines. So again, he's saying in essence that we must accept the world, but have the wisdom to perceive the eternal behind the play of time, to perceive the one behind the many which are at play, to perceive the reconciliation in that oneness behind all apparent oppositions and discords. Going back to the first chapter, all problems of life are problems of harmony. It is gaining the ground of oneness in which we finalize our divorce from ignorance, not from the many. So Sri Aurobindo in the next paragraph writes, we will put aside then the trenchant distinctions of a partial logic which declares that because the one is the reality, the many are an illusion, and because the absolute is sat, the one existence, the relative, is asat and non-existent. If in the many we pursue insistently the one, it is to return with the benediction and the revelation of the one confirming itself in the many. Wonderful sentence. Yeah. He writes with a power which goes beyond rhetoric. This is not merely a high-sounding phrase. We feel the reverberations of truth in this because it is true to his experience. And he insists that it can be true to our experience as well. So we'll go on. We will guard ourselves also against the excessive importance that the mind attaches to particular points of view at which it arrives in its more powerful expansions and transitions. The perception of the spiritualized mind that the universe is an unreal dream can have no more absolute value to us than the perception of the materialized mind that God and the beyond are an illusory idea. Sri Aurobindo will not be confined to either camp. And in a way, we are back to the beginning, aren't we? This is his initial argument. In the one case, the mind, habituated only to the evidence of the senses, and associating reality with corporeal fact, is either unaccustomed to use other means of knowledge or unable to extend the notion of reality to a supraphysical experience, and thus the lapse of materialism as being ultimately useful to the soul, or shall we say exclusively useful to the soul. In the other case, the same mind, passing beyond to the overwhelming experience of an incorporeal reality, simply transfers the same inability and the same consequent sense of dream or hallucination to the experience of the senses. So, an equal error. But we perceive also the truth that these two conceptions disfigure. It is true that for this world of form in which we are set for our self-realization, nothing is entirely valid until it has possessed itself of our physical consciousness and manifested on the lowest levels in harmony with its manifestation on the highest summits. So however high we go in our movement of transcendence, once we have captured that consciousness or been captured by it, we must return with it into the sinews, into the bones of the earth, and made it material here for it really to count, until we have given it material form. In other words, until we have made it part of the evolutionary process. We have not finished our work, and we cannot claim victory, it would be premature. It is equally true that form and matter asserting themselves as a self-existent reality are an illusion of ignorance. Form and matter can be valid only as shape and substance of manifestation for the incorporeal and immaterial. They are, in their nature, an act of divine consciousness, in their aim, the representation of a status of the spirit. They are the shell, they are the shaping of the spiritual substance, which is both intelligent, conscious, deliberate, living, immaterial, but seeking material form. So they have validity to that extent, but absent the presence of that spiritual stuff, they are void. They are a vacuum. In fact, they cannot exist. And the fact that they are here means that they are a shaping of spiritual stuff. So Sri Aurobindo continues in the next paragraph. In other words, if Brahman has entered into form and represented its being in material substance, it can only be to enjoy self-manifestation in the figures of relative and phenomenal consciousness. It is an intentional play of delight. Brahman has left infinity and become finite to enjoy itself. Brahman is in this world to represent itself in the values of life. Life exists in Brahman in order to discover Brahman in itself. So there's an implied purpose and a value merely in being here in this manifestation, which must reveal itself in the developing play of the cosmos. And next, this important sentence. Therefore, man's importance in the world is that he gives to it that development of consciousness in which its transfiguration by a perfect self-discovery becomes possible. it is a linchpin in the cosmic working that is the place which the human holds. The soul, having taken birth, takes birth with a cosmic meaning. The individual is not isolated or abstracted from the universe as a whole. Its meaning and purpose is bound up with the lattice work of it all. And as it works for its own greater knowledge, for its own release from bondage, for its emergence from ignorance into light, so too it works on behalf of the cosmos as a whole and for all its fellows. It is the widest community that benefits from the liberation of the individual soul. And Sri Aurobindo will be saying this in a most powerful way in coming paragraphs. So let's go a bit farther. But as in thought, so in life, the true rule of self-realization is a progressive comprehension. Brahman expresses itself in many successive forms of consciousness, successive in their relation, even if coexistent in being or coeval in time. And life, in its self-unfolding, must also rise to ever new provinces of its own being. But if in passing from one domain to another, we renounce what has already been given us from eagerness for our new attainment, if in reaching the mental life we cast away or belittle the physical life, which is our basis, or if we reject the mental and physical in our attraction to the spiritual, we do not fulfill God integrally, nor satisfy the conditions of his self-manifestation. We do not become perfect, but only shift the field of our imperfection, or at most attain a limited altitude. And this goes back to the start of our chapter and these citations from the Isha Upanishad. Because if we determine that we are essentially spiritual, and that's all we need, then the manifestation which the divine has intentionally unrolled becomes foreign to us, and we no longer participate in its development. We have hide away to spiritual heights. We sit on the summits. We no longer participate in the world. And the world cannot benefit from whatever consciousness and whatever power has come to us. Our evolution has taken us away from the world, or seemingly so, because real evolution always binds the spiritual attainment back to matter. It is evolving in the material casements that really helps us and fulfills God in the world, and helps the world fulfill itself in God. So let me read that last sentence again. I think it's the last one we read. We do not become perfect, but only shift the field of our imperfection, or at most attain a limited altitude. However high we may climb, even though it be to the non-being itself, and here Sri Aurobindo refers to the unknowable absolute, we climb ill if we forget our base. not to abandon the lower to itself, but to transfigure it in the light of the higher to which we have attained, is true divinity of nature. Brahman is integral and unifies many states of consciousness at a time. We also, manifesting the nature of Brahman, should become integral and all-embracing. And you might want to place a star next to that. This also becomes axiomatic to Sri Aurobindo's view of things. And this idea of integrality, of course, is the watchword of his yoga, the integral yoga. This idea, which we've seen him already touch upon in earlier chapters, again we can trace to the Bhagavad Gita and to passages in various Upanishads. This idea that what in us is real and central is identical to that which is real and central in all of reality. It's real and true in the Supreme and in the universe and in us, and we should be capable of expressing the transcendent in a universalized individuality. That we should not be simply confined to the ego base, but should be able to live widely in commonality with everything, but always expressing valuations of what is infinite. Let's try one more paragraph. Besides the recoil from the physical life, there is another exaggeration of the ascetic impulse which this ideal of an integral manifestation corrects. The notice of life is the relation between three general forms of consciousness, the individual, the universal, and the transcendent or supracosmic. In the ordinary distribution of life's activities, the individual regards himself as a separate being included in the universe and both as dependent upon that which transcends alike the universe and the individual. It is to this transcendence that we give currently the name of God, who thus becomes to our conceptions not so much supracosmic as extracosmic. Supracosmic would mean what is beyond or above the cosmos. Extracosmic would mean what is outside the cosmos. And there are, of course, religions which have that view. Theistic religions have this view that God is outside the universe, does not live in it, does not penetrate it, because he is perfect and the world is imperfect, therefore they are eternally opposite. And the world is a creation that exists in a space and time that's devoid of God's presence. This is not the Indian view of things, but it is a possible view if you start assigning too great an importance to this transcendence. Now, we're going to spend a good deal of time on this idea next week, so we won't go very much farther, but let's do finish this paragraph. The belittling and degradation of both the individual and the universe is a natural consequence of this division. The cessation of both cosmos and individual by the attainment of the transcendence would be logically its supreme conclusion. So these paths of asceticism, whether they're Buddhistic or whether they're schools of extreme Vedanta, carry the aspiring soul out of the world, out of the manifestation. They do not come back to redeem it. Now, not all schools of yoga aim at that. In fact, I don't know that you could say that either Buddhism or Shankara school is actually yogic. But they are spiritual schools. They certainly aim at and achieve enlightenment in various grades and scopes. But both, at least in their original intimations, insisted on leaving this plane of existence and going beyond. So I think this would be a good place to put our markers, and we'll take what remains of the chapter next week, the destiny of the individual. We've hardly begun to enter into the question of individuality yet, so stay tuned, as they say. May I answer any questions that you have? So I think we can go now for our meditation. Thank you for being with us tonight. Namaste. Jai Ma. And to all of our friends on Zoom, good night.